Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. I'm sorry I'm a few seconds late here, a few minutes late. Tonight we're going to attempt to complete the self-reliance essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I do want to thank everybody this week who have listened to. We had a nice audience for last week's show and a good archive audience for this, and I'm grateful that people appreciate it. And those of you who might not know, this is part two of self-reliance reading. Part one was on the 14th, which is still on the show page. I hope you enjoy that. I was trying to go back to see where we had left off, but there were certain parts of this essay that were so important, I felt, it's very important to go over again, possibly. And I thought I might do that. Bear with me here. I'm just trying to make pages are left here. Of course, everyone's aware that the self-reliance was a very famous, probably one of his most famous essays, and it was said that back in the 1800s, when people were settling the West, the pioneers were going West, they took a copy of Self-Reliance with them, or Emerson's essays. Very, very popular. And you can understand why. There's a spirit of self-reliance like no other time in history in this country, when people understood that it was that they were, and you got to remember, that was a time, too, when we were a sovereign nation. We weren't a corporation. We are a corporation, by the way. The United States is a corporation. It has been since 1865. Prior to that, when this book was written, this essay was written, we were a sovereign nation. We were sovereign people. We were individuals. We had individual rights, and we had every man was kind of for himself, you know, a different attitude back then. Nobody really depended on anybody but themselves. Sometimes they did the Indian Wars and so on, but back in those days, this was even prior to the Civil War. It was a different attitude, and an attitude of self-reliance, basically. And our friend really hit the nerve back then. Horace Greeley said, "Go west, young man." They went west, and they took a copy of Self-Reliance with them. That's a known fact. I'm going to start here, and I'm going to try to finish this up tonight, but I may have already read this, but I think it's important to read again. "Let a man then know his worth, and keep things under his feet. Let him not peep or steal or skulk up and down with the air of a charity boy, a bastard, or an interloper in the world which exists for him. But the man in the street, finding no worth in himself which corresponds to the force which built a tower or sculpted a marble god, feels poor when he looks on these. To him a palace, a statue, or a costly book have an alien and forbidding air, much like a gay equipage, and seem to say like that, 'Who are you, sir?' Yet they all are his, suitors for his notice, petitioners to his facilities, that they will come out and take possession. The picture waits for my verdict. It is not a command. It is not to command me. But I am to settle its claim to praise. That popular fate of the sot who was picked up dead drunk in the street, carried to the Duke's house, washed and dressed and laid in the Duke's bed, and on his waking, treated with an obsequious ceremony like the Duke, and assured that he had been insane, owes its popularity to the fact that it symbolizes so well the state of man, who in the world a sort of sot, but now and then wakes up, exercises his reason, and finds himself a true prince. And I'm just going to go back on one thing when he's saying that it's up to you to interpret the picture. Don't depend on somebody who says, oh, it's a wonderful picture or it's a wonderful work of art. And you're looking at it and going, what the hell is it? All right? Your opinion of what you like is as good as the next guy. And, you know, and that's what he's saying. And your opinion as your feelings are as valuable to you as this other guy's feelings or opinions are to him. So, you know, don't be intimidated by what other people think or say. And don't follow. He's saying don't follow somebody else's thoughts or opinions, you know, if they don't, you know, without criticism, without thought of yourself. Our reading is mendicant and sycophantic. In history, our imagination plays us false. Kingdom and lordship, power and estate are a gaudier vocabulary than Private John and Edward in a small house and common day's work. But the things of life are the same to both. The sum total of both is the same. Why all this deference to Alfred and Skanderbeg and Gustavus? Suppose they were virtuous. Did they wear out virtue? As great a stake depends on your private act today as follow their public and renowned steps. When private men shall act with original views, the luster will be transferred from the actions of the kings to those of gentlemen. The world has been instructed by its kings who have so magnetized the eyes of nations. It has been taught by this colossal symbol, the mutual reverence that is due from man to man. The joyful loyalty with which men have everywhere suffered the king of the noble or the great proprietor to walk among them by a law of his own, make his own scale of men and things, and reverse theirs, pay for benefits not with money but with honor, and represent the law in his person, was the hieroglyphic by which they obscurely signified their consciousness of their own right and comeliness and the right of every man. So don't bow to kings and royalty and, you know, people of supposed merit, you know. If you look at what they really did or who they really are, it's, you know, it's no better than you. They just had better acquaintances, better, richer relatives, right? You know, better opportunities. But overall, they're just as valuable as you are, as an individual. And the magnetism which all original action exerts is explained when we inquire the reason of self-trust. Who is the trustee? What is the aboriginal self on which a universal reliance may be grounded? What is the nature and power of that science-baffling star without parallax, without calculable elements, which shoots a ray of beauty even into trivial and impure actions if the least mark of independence appear? The inquiry leads us to that source at once and the essence of genius, of virtue, and of life, which we call spontaneity or instinct. We denote this primary wisdom as intuition, whilst all later teachings are tuitions. in that deep force, the last fact behind which analysis cannot go, all things find their common origin. For the sense of being which in calm hours rises, we know not how in the soul, we know not how in the soul is not diverse from things, from space, from light, from time, from man, but one with them and proceeds obviously from the same source whence their life and beings also proceed. So basically we're all the same. We all come from the same place, the same soul, the same, we're born, we're created in the same way. Right? And then we take on different traits, but each trait and each characteristic is different and is what gives us character. And it's up to us to try to perfect that character. We first share the life by which things exist, and afterwards see them as appearances in nature, and forget that we have shared their cause. Here is the fountain of action and of thought. Here are the lungs of that inspiration which giveth man wisdom and which cannot be denied without impiety and atheism. We lie in the lap of immense intelligence, which makes us receivers of its truths and its truth and organs of its activity. When we discern justice, when we discern truth, we do nothing of ourselves, but allow a passage to its beams. If we ask whence this comes, if we seek to pry into the soul that causes all philosophy, is at fault. Its presence or its absence is all we can affirm. Whether it's there or it's not there, we know. We know when we're in the presence of truth. We know that. We know and inherently know. And we inherently, or intuitively, I should say, know that when we're being taught bullshit and when we're being taught reality and what's real and what's not real, all right? Intuitively, we know that. However, socially, we have a tendency to bend toward, and we have a tendency to be herded into, if he thinks it's right, then it's right. But people are inherently lazy. They don't like to think for themselves. You know, they just don't. That's why they join parties. That's why they join political parties. That's why they go to these schools or these, it's all a branding, you know, we follow the party line, you know, or we follow this or we follow that. Well, that's bull. You know, the only reason we follow this religion or that religion, all right, and the only reason for that is because, they're too lazy or they're too frightened or too insecure to think for themselves. And man, the day that people start thinking for themselves, God, I mean, we're in for a revelation. And that's what Emerson said 200 years ago, you know, think for yourself, be yourself, you know, respect yourself. You can do it all. My willful action and acquisitions are but roving, and the idlest reverie, the faintest native emotion, command my curiosity and respect. Foulest people contradict as readily the statement of perceptions as of opinions, or rather, much more readily, for they do not distinguish between perception and notion. They fancy that I choose to see this or that thing, but perception is not whimsical, but fatal. If I see a trait, my children will see it after me, and in course of time, all mankind, although it may chance that no one has seen it before me, for my perception of it is as much a fact as the sun. So however you perceive something is fact to you. You know, if the tree is green and brown and this sky is blue, then that's what it is. That's what you're seeing, right? That's what it is to you. And whatever those emotions or whatever it evokes within you is truth, right? And if you see somebody and they say, that guy's an asshole, or she's a liar, or he's a liar, what a jerk, or he's a criminal. That is also coming from your gut. You know, you're making an emotional and an intuitive judgment, right, on something or some event or some what. And once you become aware, once you grab on to understanding and believing in yourself, believing in who you are, what you are, where you are, and you know, and that you are equal to anyone, all right, then you know and you trust yourself and you trust your intuition, right? But remember, when you do that, remember that your intuition is that center, that part of you that sometimes you can't fully understand as well. You don't know why you feel the way you do about something. You don't know why you're attracted to this or opposed to that. And, you know, those who can truly trust their intuition all the time, and I've worked on that for many, many years and tried, and I've failed. We always want to hold on to the rail somewhere, you know. Want to lean on something. I always want to fact check or whatever it may be, you know, and knowing that full well that, boy, I shouldn't have married that person, or I shouldn't have taken that position, or I shouldn't have bought that car, or I shouldn't have done this or that. And I knew it when I did it, but after I did it, I really, you know, that kind of thing. So you have to trust that quiet voice inside you always, you know, before you make a decision. Even when taking a multiple choice test, it's always stated that your first feeling, your first gut feeling to an answer is the correct one. No. And it will go on. Magnetism, which all original action exerts, is explained when we inquire the reason of self-trust. Who is the trustee? What is the aboriginal self on which the universe reliance may be grounded? What is the nature and power of the science-baffling star without peril? I already read this. The relations of the soul to the divine spirit are so pure that it is profane to seek to interpose helps. It must be that when God speaketh, he should communicate not one thing, but all things, should fill the world with his voice, should scatter forth light, nature, time, souls from the center of the present thought, and new date and new create the whole. Whenever a mind is simple and receives a divine wisdom, all things pass away. Means teachers, texts, temples fall. It lives now and absorbs past and future into the present hour. All things are made sacred by relation to it, one as much as another. All things are dissolved to their center by their cause, and in the universal miracle, petty and particular miracles disappear. If therefore a man claims to know and speak of God and carries you backward to the phraseology of some old moldered nation in another country, in another world, believe him not. Is the acorn better than the oak when it is in fullness and completion? Is the parent better than the child into whom he has cast his ripened being? And whence then his worship of the past? The centuries are conspirators against the sanity and authority of the soul. Time and space are but psychological colors which the eyes make, but the soul is light. Where it is day. Where it was is night. And history is an impetuance and an injury, if it be anything more than a cheerful epilogue or parable of my being and becoming. Man is timid and apologetic. He is no longer upright. He dares not say, I think I am, but quotes some saint or sage. He is ashamed before the blade of grass or the blowing rose. These roses under my window make no reference to former roses or to better ones. They are for what they are. They exist with God today. There is no time to them. There is simply the rose. It is perfect in every moment of its existence. Before a leaf bud has burst, its whole life acts in the full-blown flower. There is no more. In a leafless root, there is no less. Its nature is satisfied, and it satisfies nature in all moments alike. But man postpones on remembers. He does not live in the present, but with reverted eye laments the past, or heedless of the riches that surround him, stands on tiptoe to foresee the future, and he cannot be happy and strong until he too lives with nature in the present above time. And we all do that. I do that. You know, I read tarot, and we all do that. We tiptoe to see the future or to understand the past. But what Emerson is saying is don't do that. Just accept it. Accept who you are. He cannot be happy and strong until he too lives with nature in the present above time. This soon be plain enough. This should be plain enough, rather. Yet see that strong intellects dare not yet hear God himself unless he speaks the phraseology of I know not what David or Jeremiah or Paul. He shall not always set so great a price on a few texts, on a few lives. We are like children who repeat by rote the sentences of granddams and tutors, and as they grow older, of the men of talents and character they chance to see, painfully recollecting the exact words. Understand them and are willing to let the words go, for at any time they can use words as good when occasion comes. If we live truly, we shall see truly. It is as easy for the strong man to be as strong as it is for the weak to be weak, and when we have new perception, we shall gladly disburden the memory of its hoarded treasures and old rubbish. When a man lives with God, his voice shall be as sweet as the murmur of the brook and the rustle of the corn. And now, at last, the highest truth on this subject remains unsaid. Probably cannot be said, for all that we say is the far-off remembering of the intuition. That thought by what I can now nearest approach to say it is this. When good is near you, when you have life in yourself. It is not by any known or accustomed way. You shall not discern the footprint of any other. You shall not see the face of man. You shall not hear any name. The way, the thought, and the good shall be wholly strange and new. It shall exclude example and experience. You take the way from man, not to man. All persons that ever existed are its forgotten ministers. Fear and hope are alike beneath it. There is somewhat low even in hope. In the hours of vision, there is nothing that can be called gratitude, nor properly joy. The soul raised over passion beholds identity and eternal causation, perceives the self-existence of truth and right, and calms itself with knowing that all things go well, vast spaces of nature at the Atlantic Ocean, South Sea, long intervals of time, years, centuries, are of no account. This which I think and feel underlay every former state of life and circumstances, as it does underlie my present, and what is called life and what is called death. So that's the exact present. We live in the immediate present. Live in the immediate present, and all else is irrelevant. And life only avails, not the having lived. Power ceases in the instant of repose. It resides in the moment of transition from past to a new state, in the shooting of the gulf, in the darting to the aim, to an aim. This one fact the world relates, that the soul becomes, for that forever degrades the past, turns all riches to poverty, all reputation to a shame, confounds the saint and the rogue, shoves Jesus and Judas equally aside. Why then do we prate of self-reliance? Inasmuch as the soul is present, there will be power not confident, but agent. To talk of reliance is a poor external way of speaking. Speak rather of that which relies because it works and is. Who has more obedience than I masters me, though he should not raise his finger? Round him I must resolve by the gravitation of spirits. We fancy it rhetoric when we speak of eminent virtue. We do not yet see that virtue is height, and that a man or a company of men plastic and permeable to principles, but the law of nature must overpower and ride all cities, nations, kings, rich men, poets, who are not. This is the ultimate fact, which we so quickly reach on this, as on every topic, the resolution of all into the ever-blessed one. Self-existence is the attribute of supreme cause, and it constitutes the measure of good by the degree in which it enters into all lower forms. All things real are so, but so much virtue as they contain. Commerce, husbandry, hunting, whaling, war, eloquence, personal weight are somewhat and engaged by respect as examples of its presence and impure action. I see the same law working in nature for conservation and growth. Power is in nature, the essential measure of right. Nature suffers nothing to remain in her kingdom which cannot help itself. The genesis and maturation of a planet, its poise and orbit, the bending tree recovering itself from the strong wind, the vital resource of every animal and vegetable are demonstrations of the self-sufficing and therefore self-relying soul. And thus all concentrates. Let us not rove. Let us sit at home with the cause. Let us stun and astonish the intruding rabble of men and books and intuitions or institutions by a simple declaration of the divine fact. Bid the invaders take the shoes from off their feet, for God is here within. And let our simplicity judge them, and our docility to do our own law demonstrate the poverty of nature and the fortune beside our native riches. But now we are a mob. Man does not stand in awe of man, nor in his genius admonished to stay at home, to put itself in communication in the eternal ocean. But it goes abroad to beg a cup of water or the urns of other men. We must go alone. I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. How far off, how cool, how chaste the persons look, vigor each one with a precinct or sanctuary. So let us always sit. Why should we assume the faults of our friends or wife or father or child because they sit around our hearth or are said to have the same blood? All men have my blood, and I all men's. Not for that will I adopt their petulance or folly, even to the extent of being ashamed of it. But your insulation, must not be mechanical, but spiritual. That is, must be elevation. At times, the whole world seems to be in conspiracy to importune you with emphatic trifles. Friends, clients, child, sickness, fear, want, charity, all knock at once at thy closet door and say, come not unto us, but keep thy state. Come out into their confusion. The power men possess to annoy me, I give them by a weak curiosity. No man can come near me, but through my act. And what we love and what we have, what we love that we have, but by desire we bereave ourselves of the love. If we cannot at once rise to the sanctities of the obedience and faith, let us at least resist our temptations. Let us enter into the state of war and wake Thor and Woden, courage and constancy in our Saxon breasts. This is to be done in our smooth times by speaking the truth. Check this lying hospitality and lying affection. Live no longer in the expectation of these deceived and deceiving people with whom we converse. Say to them, O father, O mother, O wife, O brother, O friend, I have lived with you after appearances hitherto. Henceforward, I am the truth. Be it known unto you that henceforth I obey no law less than the eternal law. I will have no covenants but proximities. I shall endeavor to nourish my parents, to support my family, to be the chaste husband of one wife. But these relations I must fill after a new and unprecedented way. I appeal from your customs. I must be myself. I cannot break myself any longer from you. If you can love me for what I am, we shall be the happier. If you cannot, I will still seek to deserve that you should. I will not hide my tastes or aversions. I will so trust that what is deep in is holy, that I will do strongly before the sun and moon whatever inly rejoices me and the heart appoints. If you are noble, I will love you. If you are not, I will not hurt you and myself by hypocritical attentions. If you are true, but not in the same truth with me, cleave to your companions. I will seek my own. I do this not selfishly, but humbly and truly. It is like your interest and mine and all men's, however long we have dwelt in lies, to live in truth. Does this sound harsh today? You will soon love what is dictated by your nature as well as mine. And if we follow the truth, it will bring us out safe at light. But so may you give these friends pain. Yes, but I cannot sell my liberty and my power to save their sensibility. Besides, all persons have their moments of reason. When they look out into the region of absolute truth, then will they justify me and do the same thing. And at that point, I just feel I need to stop for a second and just say that, you know, we all have people and family and friends and whatnot that suffocate us and try to make us go along with whatever insipid or insane idea they may have, all right? And we know that's not right. We follow our own selves. We know what's right. We know what's wrong. And it's only when we deviate from that path, that we fall, that we fail ourselves, that we fail our families, that we fail our friends, is that we fail when we do not follow our own heart, when we do not follow our own thoughts, our own individual ideas. All right, and destiny, and when we're some people are extremely weak, and they have addictions, and they have obsessions, and they have the need to be cool, and they have the need to be popular, and they have the need to be accepted. So they'll do whatever it is, even if it's against their own conscience, to do it. You know, just because of that obsession or that drive for something else, that unreasonable illusion that they want to achieve. is betraying them, betraying their own selves. But unfortunately, we still, I mean, we see people, the American Idols, or the great Shazam, or whoever the hell is famous tomorrow or today, and we say, oh, geez, to be like them, wouldn't it be great to be like them? When's my turn going to come? When am I? Well, you know, it'll come if it's meant to come, if it's meant to be. It'll be there. You have to have faith that it will be, and that you're working constantly at that, and keep going, and keep going, and keep going. And there's one thing that I learned many years ago, and that's delay is not denial. That was said by somebody great, I don't know who, but delay is not denial. And if you're doing everything you can to enlighten yourself and to better yourself and to honor yourself, then, and honor those that are with you, or those that are your friends or your family or whatever, your spouse, your children, then you're doing the right thing. Regardless of what you're doing for a living, as long as it's not illegal or criminal act, or you're not killing somebody, you know, you're stealing from somebody, as long as you're doing an honest day's work or an honest whatever it may be, and you have integrity, then you're doing the right thing. You know, you have to believe that, and you have to believe that as long as you follow that course, you will achieve what you need. And it depends on what happens so much. It depends on how ambitious you are. You know, I always wondered. Sometimes I used to wonder, well, gee, will I get this or will I get that? Depending on how big or how mammoth the vision may be. Yeah, well, it takes a little while sometimes to conjure up, figure out how to achieve what you want to achieve. Like, if you want to create a successful business, or you want to, you know, be a rock star, or whatever you want to be, it takes time to develop that. You have to practice, and you have to acquire the talents and the savvy, the understanding, the business, and then you have to have the drive and the incessant drive that's what you want to do, and you want to enjoy it constantly, what you're doing. You don't want to be whatever you're trying to do shouldn't make you miserable. Whatever you're trying to be shouldn't make you miserable. It should make you happy. It should make you joyous every day that you're doing what you want to do, and you're striving to get to the level of perfection or the level of professionalism or whatever that may be, that will eventually bring about the rewards, monetary and social and spiritual and whatever joy there is that you're seeking. All of those joys will come back to you, will you achieve, as long as you stay on the path that you intuitively know is the right path for you. And it's hard. It'll be hard. You'll get criticism. You'll get scorned. You'll get. You may get fired from a job. You may get you may be on the most wanted list by the Obama administration for your criticism of them. But you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because if you are right in what you believe and you're doing the right thing, then people know that you are honest. People know that you're right. People, the world cooperates with you eventually. But they want you to be courageous. They want to see this courage. They want to see this person trying, honestly trying to learn and to do and to achieve. And then what happens is, as you want that and as you work toward that, all of the things that you are seeking come to you through the law of attraction. And eventually you will achieve it. But you have to be on the right track. You have to understand that, you know, you just have to. And fate is so fickle in that, and you know, you may think you have the greatest thing, invention, or you might have the truth, you might have found the truth. You may have an engine that when there are people that have created engines or motors that work, that operate on air. They don't need fuel other than compressed air. And they're frustrated to no end because the powers that be, the oil companies and auto companies and whatnot, and investors don't want to invest in you or them. They don't want, or they will try to buy out your technology and to suppress it. These things happen all the time. That happens in the medical profession, happens in the, you know, any place where mankind is coming up with invention. So, but you have to keep pursuing it. Keep pursuing it. Don't lose faith in it. And sooner or later, it'll work. You just have to have faith in it. And I'm going to keep going with this here. The populace think that your rejection of popular standards is a rejection of all standard. And mere antinomianism and the bold sensualist will use the name of philosophy to gild his crimes. But the law of consciousness abides. There are two concessionals in one, and the other is... there are two confessionals in one or the other of which we have been shriven. You may fulfill your round of duties by clearing yourself in the direct or in the reflex way. Consider whether you have satisfied your relations to your father, mother, cousin, neighbor, town, cat, and dog, whether any of these can upbraid you. But I may also neglect this reflex standard and absolve me to myself. I have my own stern claims in perfect circle. It denies the name of duty to many offices that are called duties. But if I can discharge its debts, it enables me to dispense with the popular code. If anyone imagines that this law is lax, let him keep its commandment one day. In other words, he's saying that you don't have to be everything to everybody other than being what you are to yourself, right? And truly, it demands something godlike in him who has cast off the common motives of humanity and has ventured to trust himself for a taskmaster. High be his heart, faithful his will, clear his sight, and he may in good earnest be doctrine, society, law to himself, that a simple purpose may be to him as strong as iron necessity is to others. If any man consider their present aspects of what is called by distinction society, he will see the need of these ethics. The sinew and heart of man seem to be drawn out, and we are become timorous, desponding, whimperers. We are afraid of truth, afraid of fortune, afraid of death, and afraid of each other. Our age yields no great and perfect persons. We want men and women who shall renovate life and our social state, but we see that most natures are insolvent, cannot satisfy their own wants, have an ambition out of all proportion to their practical force, and do lean and beg day and night continually. Our housekeeping is mendicant, our hearts, our occupations, our marriages, our religions, we have not chosen, but society has chosen for us. We are power soldiers. We shun the rugged battle of fate where strength is born. If our young men miscarry in their first enterprises, they lose all heart. If the young merchant fails, men say he is ruined. If the finest genius studies at one of our colleges and is not installed in an office within 1 year afterward in the cities or suburbs of Boston or New York, it seems to his friends and to himself that he is right in being disheartened and is complaining the rest of his life. A sturdy lad from New Hampshire or Vermont, who in turn tries all the professions, who teams it, farms it, peddles it, keeps a school, preaches, edits a newspaper, goes to Congress, buys a township, and so forth, in successive years, and always like a cat falls on his feet, is worth 100 of these city dolls. He walks abreast with his days and feels no shame in not studying a profession, for he does not postpone his life, but lives already. He has not one chance, but 100 chances. Let a Stoic open the resources of man and tell men they are not leaning willows, but can and must detach themselves. That with the exercise of self-trust, new powers shall appear. That a man is the Word made flesh, born to shed healings to the nation, that he should be ashamed of our compassion, and that the moment he acts from himself, tossing the laws, the books, idolatries, and customs out the window, we pity him no more, but thank and revere him. And that teacher shall restore the life of a man to splendor, and make his name dear to all history. And essentially, that's what Christ did. That's what Buddha did. That's what Muhammad did. That's what all the prophets did. They said, damn these things. Damn this history. Damn this society. It's wrong. And this is why. It is easy to see that a greater self-reliance must work the revolution in all the offices and regulations of men, in their religion, in their education, and in their pursuits, their modes of living, their associations, in their property, in their speculative views. One, in what prayer do men allow themselves? That which they call a holy office is not so much as brave as and manly. Prayer looks abroad and asks for some foreign addition to come through, some foreign virtue, and loses itself in endless mazes of natural and supernatural and meditorial and miraculous. Prayer that craves a particular commodity, anything less than all good, is vicious. Prayer is the contemplation of the facts of life from the highest point of view. It is the soliloquy of a beholding and jubilant soul. It is the Spirit of God pronouncing his works good. But prayer as a means to effect a private end is meanness and theft. It supposes dualism and not unity in nature and consciousness. As soon as the man is at one with God, he will not beg. He will then see prayer in all action. And the prayer of the farmer kneeling in his field to weed it, the prayer of the rower kneeling with the stroke of his oar, are true prayers heard throughout nature, though for cheap ends, Cataract and Fletcher's Bonaduce, when admonished to inquire the minds of the god, Audit replies, his hidden meaning lies in our endeavors, and our valors are our best gods. So, we continually are in prayer of some sort if we are within ourselves. If we are self-reliant, if we continue to live within the best, do the best for ourselves and our families and those we love, we are in essence worshiping God, because that God is within us. And even like the farmer who's kneeling in his field, or the roarers rowing in his boat, or the guy who's working at his office, or the, you know, whatever. Another sort of false prayers are our regrets. Discontent is the want of self-reliance. It is infirmity of will. Regret calamities if you can thereby help the sufferer. If not, attend to your own work, and already the evils begin to be repaired. Our sympathy is just as base. We come to them who weep foolishly and sit down and cry for company. We instead of imparting to them truth and health and rough electric shocks, putting them once more in communication with their own reason. The secret of fortune is joy in our hands. Welcome evermore to gods and men in the self-helping man. For him all doors are flung wide, him tongues greet, all honor crowns, all eyes follow with desire. Our love goes out to him and embraces him because he did not need it. We solicitously and apologetically caress and celebrate him because he held on his way and scorned our disappropriation. The gods love him because men hated him. And to the persevering mortal, said Zoroaster, the blessed immortals are swift. As men's prayers are a disease of the will, so are their creeds a disease of the intellect. They say with those foolish Israelites, let not God speak to us, lest we die. Speak any man with us, and we will obey. Everywhere I am hindered of beating God in my brother, because he has shut his own temple doors and recites fables merely of his brothers or his brother's brother's God. Every new mind is a new classification. If it prove a mind of uncommon activity and power, a Locke, a Levasseur, a Hutton, or a Bentham, or a Fourier, it imposes its classification on other men, and lo, a new system. In proportion to the depth of the thought, and so to the number of people it touches and brings within reach of the pupil, is his complacency. But chiefly is this apparent in creeds and churches, which are also classifications of some powerful minds acting on the elemental thoughts of duty and man relation to the highest, such as Calvin, Quakerism, Swedenborgism. The pupil takes the same delight in subordinating everything to the new terminology as a girl who has just learned botany is seeing a new earth and new seasons thereby. It will happen for a time that the pupil will find his intellectual power has grown by the study of his master's mind. But in all unbalanced minds, the classification is idolized, passed for the end and not for a speedily exhaustible means, so that the walls of the system blend to their eye in the remote horizon with the walls of the universe. The luminaries of heaven seem to them hung on the ark their masters built, and they cannot imagine how you aliens have any right to see, how you can see. It must be somehow that you stole the light from us. They do not yet perceive that light, unsystematic, indomitable, will break into any cabin, even into theirs. Let them chirp a while and call it their own. If they are honest and do well, presently their neat new pinfold will be too straight and low, will crack, will lean, will rot and varnish, and the immortal light, all boy, all young and joyous, million-orbed, million-colored, will beam over the universe as on the first morning. They're just saying, don't, you know, follow if you want, you know, believe in anybody, but you know, don't do it without, you know, to just understand that you are as what you believe and what you know is as valuable as what they know, any master or any religion or anything you know, because you're a creation of God. It is for want of self-culture that the superstition of traveling, whose idols are Italy, England, and Egypt, retain its fascination for all educated Americans. Let's see, I've got just a few more pages left, so hopefully we can get through this. The soul is no traveler. The wise man stays at home. And when his necessities, his duties, on any occasion call him from his house or into foreign lands, he is at home still and shall make men sensible by the expression of his countenance that he goes, the missionary of wisdom and virtue, and visits cities and men like a sovereign and not like an interloper or a valet. I have no churlish objection to the circumnavigation of the globe for the purpose of art or study and benevolence, so that the man is first domesticated, or does not go abroad with the hope of finding somewhat greater than he knows. He who travels to be amused, or to get somewhat which he does not carry, travels away from himself, and grows old even in youths among old things. And Thebes and Palmyra, his will and mind have become old and dilapidated as they. He carries ruins to ruins. Traveling is a fool's paradise. Our first journeys discover to us the different differences of places. At home I dream that at Naples, at Rome, I can be intoxicated with beauty and lose my sadness. I pack my trunk, embrace my friends, embark on the sea, and at last wake up in Naples, and there beside me is the stern fact, the sad self, unrelenting, undead, identical, that I fled from. I seek the Vatican and the palaces. I affect to be intoxicated with sights and suggestions, but I am not intoxicated. My giant goes with me wherever I go. But the rage of traveling is a symptom of a deeper unsoundness affecting the whole intellectual action. The intellect is a vagabond, and our system of education fosters restlessness, and our mind travels when our bodies are forced to stay at home. We imitate. And what is imitation but the traveling of the mind? Our houses are built with foreign tastes. Our shelves are garnished with foreign ornaments. Our opinions, our tastes, our facilities lean and follow the past and distant. The soul creates the arts wherever they are flourished. It was in his own mind that the artist sought his model. It was an application of his own thought to the thing to be done and the condition to be observed. And why need we copy the Doric or the Gothic model? Beauty, convenience, grandeur of thought, and quaint expression are as near to us as to any. And if the American artist will study with hope and love the precise thing to be done by him, considering the climate, the soil, the length of day, the want of the people, and the habit and form of the government, he will create a house in which all these will find themselves fitted, and taste and sentiment will be satisfied also. Insist on yourself, and never imitate. Your own gift you can present every moment with the cumulative force of a whole life's cultivation. But of the adopted talent of another, you have only an extemporaneous half possession. That which each can do best, none but his master can teach him, and no man yet knows what it is, nor can till that person has exhibited it. Where is the master who could have taught Shakespeare? Where is the master who could have instructed Franklin or Washington or Bacon or Newton? Every great man is a unique. Shakespeare will never be made by the study of Shakespeare. And do that which is assigned you, and you cannot hope to dare too much. There is at this moment for you an utterance brave and grand as that of the colossal chisels of Phidias, or trowel of the Egyptians, or the pen of Moses or Dante, but different from all these. Though not possible with the soul, all rich, all eloquent, with thousand cloven tongue deign to repeat itself. But if you can hear what these patriarchs say, surely you can reply to them in the same pitch of voice, for the ear and tongue are two organs of one nature. Abide in the simple and noble regions of thy life, obey thy heart, and thou shalt reproduce the foreworld again. And we're going over time here. People can't hear me anymore, but this will be in the archive here. I'm going to continue. I only have two more pages of it to read. Um, 4. As our religion, our education, our art look abroad, so does our spirit of society. All men plume themselves on the improvement of society, and no man improves. Society never advances. It recedes as fast on one side as it gains on the other. It undergoes continual changes. It is barbarous. It is civilized. It is Christianized. It is rich. It is scientific. But this change is not amelioration. For everything that is given, something is taken. Society acquires new arts and loses old instincts. What a contrast between the well-clad, reading, writing, thinking American with a watch, a pencil, and a bill of exchange in his pocket, and the naked New Zealander whose property is a club, a spear, a mat, and an undivided 20th of a shed to sleep under. But compare the health of the two men, and you shall see that the white man has lost his aboriginal strength. If the traveler tell us truly, strike the savage with a broad axe, and in a day or two the flesh shall unite and heal as if you struck the blow into a soft pitch, and the same blow shall send the white man to his grave. The civilized man has built a couch, but has lost the use of his feet. He is supported on crutches, but lacks so much support of muscle. He has a fine Geneva watch, but he fails of the skill to tell the hour by the sun. A Greenwich nautical almanac he has, and so being sure of the information when he wants it, the man in the street does not know a star in the sky. The solstice he does not observe. The equinox he knows as little, and the whole bright calendar of the year is without a dial in his mind. His notebooks impair his memory. His libraries overload his wit. The insurance office increases the number of accidents. And it may be a question whether machinery does not encumber, whether we have not lost by refinement some energy, by Christianity, entrenched in establishments and forms, some vigor of wild virtue. For every Stoic was a Stoic. But in Christendom, where is the Christians? There is no more deviation in the moral standard than in the standard of height or bulk. No greater men are now than ever were. A singular equality may be observed between the great men of the first and of the last ages, nor can all the science, art, religion, and philosophy of the 19th century avail to educate greater men than Plutarch, Ciro's 3 or 4 and 20 centuries ago, not in times in the race progressive. Socrates and Anaxagoras and Diogenes are great men, but they leave no class. He who is really of their class will not be called by their name, but will be his own man, and in his turn the founder of a sect. The art and invention of each period are only its costumes and do not invigorate men. The harm of the improved machinery may compensate its good. Hudson and Bering accomplished so much in their fishing boats as to astonish Perry and Franklin, whose equipment exhausted the resources of science and art. Galileo, with an opera glass, discovered a more splendid series of celestial phenomena than any one since. And Columbus found the new world in an undecked boat. It is curious to see the periodical disuse and perishing of means and machinery which we introduced with loud laudation a few years or centuries before. The great genius returns to essential man. We reckoned the improvements of the art of war among the triumphs of science, and yet Napoleon conquered Europe by the bivouac, which consisted of falling back on naked valor and encumbering it of all aids. The emperor held it impossible to make a perfect army, says Lacoste, without abolishing our arms, magazines, commissaries, and carriages, until in imitation of the Roman custom, the soldier should receive his supply of corn, grind it in his handmill, and bake his bread himself. Society is a wave. The wave moves onward, but the water of which it is composed does not. The same particle does not rise from the valley of the ridge. Its unity is only phenomenal. The person who makes up a nation today, next year die, and their experience dies with them. And so the reliance on property, including the reliance on governments which protect it, is the want of self-reliance. Men have looked away from themselves and at things so long that they have come to esteem the religious, learned, and civil institutions as guards of property, and they deprecate assault on these because they feel them to be assaults on property. They measure their esteem of each other by what each has, and not by what each is. But cultivated men become ashamed of their property out of new respect for their nature. Especially he hates what he has if he sees that it is accidental, came to him by inheritance or gift or crime. Then he feels that it is not having it. It does not belong to him, has no root in him, and merely lies there because no revolution or robber takes it away. But that which man is, does always by necessity acquire, and what the man acquires is living property, which does not wait the beck or rulers or mob or revolution or fire or storm or bankruptcies, but perpetually renews itself wherever the man breathes. A lot or portion of life, said the Caliph Ali, is seeking after thee. Therefore be at rest from seeking after it. And our independence on these foreign goods leads us to our slavish respect for others, for numbers. And for the political parties meet in numerous conventions, the greater the concourse, and with each new uproar of announcement, the delegation from Essex, the Democrats from New Hampshire, the Whigs of Maine, the young patriot feels himself stronger than before by a new thousand of eyes and arms. In like manner, the reformer summons conventions and vote and resolve a multitude. Not so. O friends, will the God deign to enter and inhabit you, but by a method precisely the reverse? It is only as a man puts off all foreign support and stands alone that I see him to be strong and to prevail. He is weaker by every recruit to his banner. It is not a man better than a town. Ask nothing of a man, and in the endless mutation, thou only firm column must presently appear, the upholder of all of these surrounds thee. He who knows that power is inborn, that he is weak because he has looked for good out of him and elsewhere, and so perceiving, throws himself unhesitatingly on his thought, instantly rights himself, stands in the erect position, commands his limbs, works miracles, just as a man who stands on his feet is stronger than a man who stands on his head. So use all that is called fortune. Most men gamble with her, and gain all and lose all at her wheel's roll. But do thou leave as unlawful these winnings, and deal with cause and effect, the chancellors of God. In the will, work and acquire, and thou hast chained the wheel of chance, and shall sit hereafter out of fear from her rotations. A political victory, a rise of rents, the recovery of your sick or the return of your absent friend, or some other favorable event raises your spirits, and you think good days are preparing for you. Do not believe it. Nothing can bring you peace but yourself, and nothing can bring you peace but the triumph of principles. And that's the end of that essay. Again, it says, nothing can bring you peace but yourself, and nothing can bring you peace but the triumph of principles. And that was Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I want to thank you for listening. If anybody's interested, the works of Emerson, you can go to a website. It's called RWE, Ralph Waldo Emerson, but it's RWE.org. And check that out. And RWE.org. And Ralph Waldo Emerson has his complete works right there online. So I hope that you enjoyed this tonight's show, and I'm grateful for those of you who listened last week. And I hope that that you got as much out of it this week, and we'll go to and visit Ralph Waldo Emerson and so much of his many, many works. I hope to be able to read some more of his works for you in the future. But for now, I'm grateful that we did this one, and self-reliance. And I wish you a good night. Oh, and you can join us tomorrow. It's Friday night at 8 o'clock with George Dixon, and we will be discussing the Mayan calendar again and proximity of where we're headed and the timeline and. And where we are in position to the in the galactic period. So good night, and thank you for listening.